Now, a subject very close to my and one other presenter's heart here is something we're going to talk about now. About 4 or 5 months ago, it must have been, I was off work for nearly a month because I had what can only describe as the world spinning around all the time. Looking up at the light tended to hurt a bit. And I had all kinds of tests done, and they never came to any conclusions. It was called various things, from an inner ear infection to labyrinthitis. And then about 6 weeks ago, I happened to be walking around the supermarket, and I suddenly felt all the same symptoms. And I remembered that it was exactly the same supermarket in the same place that I'd felt the symptoms before. And I thought, well, this is really weird. It can't be the supermarket, can it? So I go home and I use my friend Google and Google supermarket dizziness. And sure enough, up comes something called supermarket syndrome. So I look a little further into this, and it turns out that its real name is visual vertigo, and it's a real thing, and many people suffer from it. Our own Dave Hodgson right now he had about 5 weeks off, and he's still suffering from it. So we thought we'd get an expert on to talk about this, and we have Dr. Diego Kadski, who's from the Royal London Hospital, and he's set up an acute vertigo service in Charing Cross Hospital. Diego, welcome to the show.
Thank you very much indeed. Thanks for inviting me.
No problem. So the preamble there kind of points out to you that I have a little bit of personal experience in this,
yeah.
And that's what kind of prompted this. Supermarket syndrome, it's real then?
It is. As you quite rightly said, it's got lots of different names attached to it. Sort of put simply, the term visual vertigo, I think, best describes it. And it is, as you experienced, it's a sensation of dizziness or disorientation or imbalance that is triggered by busy or rich visual environments.
Right.
There's been a lot of work into this, and the earliest work dates back from the early 70s, and it was recognized as a real phenomenon back then. And really what was described was this sense of imbalance that many patients experienced when faced with busy visual environments, such as supermarket aisles, but also simpler things like, you know, ironing a striped shirt, for example, was one of the early patients that described it. A lot of the evidence suggests that actually these patients that develop visual vertigo have some sort of abnormality or imbalance in the inner ear that triggers this, or indeed in the network that connects the inner ear to the brain, the so-called vestibular network. You know, vestibular is the term we use for balance disorders. So this network extends from the inner ear through the lower parts of the brain into the top parts of the brain, which is where you perceive all the symptoms of dizziness. Often it's described in the context of having had some sort of injury to the balance system.
Right.
And that's quite relevant because there is quite an idiosyncratic relationship between who develops these symptoms of visual vertigo and why they develop them. And I think it's true that a proportion of the population are more what we call visually dependent. They rely on vision for their balance more than others.
Yep.
And in order to maintain balance, you require an integration of lots of different sensory inputs. So you look at, you know, vision tells you where you are and how you're standing, how you're moving. We also rely on hearing for
yep.
that. And we rely on our inner ear vestibular or balance organ. But also on our proprioception, which is a sense of where your joints are in space. And all this information comes into the brain, and the brain integrates all these different sensory inputs and builds a picture of how you're moving and where you're moving.
Uh-huh.
And there is a weighting for each of these different sensory modalities. So there's a percentage of information from vision that we take, a percentage of information from our inner ears that we take. And that weighting can change in some patients. And those are the patients that tend to develop these visual vertigo symptoms.
Okay, now let me take our esteemed colleague Dave as an example here, and he has actually written it in the form of a question for you, which kind of describes how he got it. 6 weeks ago, I woke up dizzy, the room wasn't spinning around, I just felt off balance. The best way I could describe it is when I'm still, I feel like I'm rocking from side to side. When I'm walking, it feels like I'm on a trampoline. It feels like my head is fuzzy and it's harder to focus. I also get more headaches now. He's had his ears syringed, no change. There's been a slight improvement, not sure if it's clearing up or I'm adapting to it more.
Yeah.
So he wakes up one morning with that. I also woke up one morning with that. And I've also got this weird thing where this particular supermarket set it off.
Yeah.
I've got several questions here, obviously, about this. Firstly, with the supermarket thing, can it be lighting that sets it off?
So it tends not to be the light itself, although lighting does make a difference. And you mentioned yourself that looking at bright lights can sometimes make things worse.
Yeah.
And that's very typical of this. So what I was going to come to is that the second scenario in which we see visual vertigo, and in my experience is the most prominent example in which we see it, is in patients that have a form of migraine, in which headaches may not be a very prominent feature, but in whom dizziness and imbalance becomes very prominent.
Yeah.
And the typical patient will be someone that has had headaches in the past, maybe in their teens, often associated with poor sleep, or not eating at regular times, or under stress. And then those headaches sort of disappear over time, and they begin to experience often suddenly, the first episode of an imbalance, a sense of imbalance. And this sense of rocking is absolutely characteristic of this form of migraine, which we term vestibular migraine.
Yeah.
And it's a sense that the body is not still, that the ground underneath you is not still, and a slight sense of disorientation. The world doesn't quite seem real or right, and you don't seem to belong in that world
exactly
in a normal way.
Yep.
And those are the typical symptoms that we see in vestibular migraine. And the word migraine is not a great one because it has connotations with headache. And, of course, what we're dealing with here is not really a headache. Although some patients will have had headaches or may have headaches with it, the main symptom is actually the dizziness.
Yeah.
But yet we still use the word migraine for that. So that's the commonest scenario in which we see visual vertigo. And as you and your colleague have probably experienced, you go and see specialists about this. They say, oh, this is interesting. We'll do some tests.
Yeah.
All the tests are normal. And you're left with this question, well, is this in my mind? Am I making this up? Have I gone crazy somehow? Could it be, as you said, lighting? Could it be situational? Is it anxiety? And it's none of those things, really. I mean, it's the reason the tests are normal is because the tests don't probe where the problem is. And the problem is not in the brain's hardware, if you like, not in the wiring of the brain, but rather in the brain's software, how the brain is processing information.
Yes.
And that's something that we can't test with any of the testing facilities we have, even with technology of the century. We still really can't test the software, and that's really where this problem lies and why it tends to be quite intermittent. It's a bit like a software problem in a computer.
How interesting. We mentioned at the beginning there that it's several terms are given to it. I mean, I've been to doctors who immediately say, oh, yes, you have an inner ear infection. That seems to be a favourite one. Go and take these tablets, it'll all be fine. And then it got escalated to, oh, no, you've definitely got labyrinthitis, which I'd never heard of and looked up. And then, it could be much worse than that. Let's send you off for some MRI scans of your brain to see what actually is going on. And at the end of the month, nothing changed and nothing was proved, as you just said there, and it sorted itself out. But for poor old Dave, my colleague here, he thought he was better, but now he's back to spinning again.
I mean, those are really common experiences that patients go through. So these terms are used interchangeably, and neurologists are quite pedantic, that's good and bad in some ways. But those terms are quite specific for us. So labyrinthitis is an inflammation of your labyrinth, and the labyrinth is in the inner ear and houses the hearing and the balance organ in the inner ear.
Mm-hmm.
So if you have an inflammation of those two organs together, you get a very distinct syndrome characterized by hearing loss, which often patients with visual vertigo do not complain of, and quite severe spinning vertigo, in which you see the world spin around quite violently for several hours.
Wow.
Often people vomit, and those patients will tend to go into A&E. So this is different, really, from what people that have the label of labyrinthitis have.
Yes.
So that label of labyrinthitis is very, very common. It's common in accident and emergency settings, and it's common in GP settings. And it's used really to describe a benign dizziness that you don't have a cause for. But it's not really the right term to use. And people that then go and Google labyrinthitis will see that the recovery can be up to 6 weeks.
Yep.
And so you get a very different flavor of what you will expect if you get that label incorrectly. So I think often that happens, and often it's a label that's given to benign dizziness of unknown cause, but actually it shouldn't be. And there, it does carry with it a very specific syndrome with positive clinical signs and abnormal test results.
Interesting. So how then is visual vertigo actually diagnosed by somebody who knows about visual vertigo?
So you can diagnose visual vertigo from the history, and also there are some specific tests that aren't in mainstream clinical practice that will gauge how visually dependent you are. And those tests, they're called the rod and frame test or rod and disc test. And they simply ask you to align a vertical rod on a computer screen from ceiling to floor in the context of visual motion around that rod. So you are asked to align a rod vertically without any visual motion first, and you should be able to do that even if you have visual vertigo. And then if you expose someone to movement of the surround, then the rod is tilted in the direction of the motion of the surround. So you are influenced by the surround.
Yeah.
And that means that you are visually dependent. Your sense of uprightness is affected by visual motion. And that details a degree of visual dependence, and that's what manifests clinically as visual vertigo.
Okay. And in the sense that if you've gone to your local GP and he's not got it right, and you've gone to a neurologist and they've not got it right, there must be a lot of people who are listening to this show now who are saying, yes, I know exactly what you're talking about there. What do they do?
So there are, fortunately, there are neuro-otologists, and that's my special interest. And these are neurologists with an interest in the balance system. And sometimes, depending on the country, there are physicians called audio-vestibular physicians, who also, their background tends to come from ear, nose and throat surgery, but they also, they're non-surgical physicians that have an interest in balance disorders. And our job really as neuro-otologists is to try and filter this information across neurological spheres, across GP spheres, so that it becomes something that is recognized. But it's not yet happened. But is one of the reasons I'm interested in coming to shows like yours, and to try and disseminate some of this knowledge, because patients can educate the medical profession too.
Yeah.
And so if patients have these disorders and they've heard and listened about these disorders, and it becomes, you know, it gets into the GP radar, I think that's really where the change starts.
Yeah, yeah. Now, to go back to our esteemed colleague Dave, he said something interesting, that there has been a slight improvement, not sure if it's clearing up, or I'm adapting to it more.
Yes.
And I kind of felt that, and I'm trying to read it between the lines here. Adapting to it may be not that good an idea then, surely?
Correct. So the adaptation that people often refer to is sometimes more an avoidance than an adaptation.
Yeah.
So what people do is they tend to avoid things that make them dizzy or unsteady or disorientated, and that's not good for real life work or even for recovery. So adaptation is good, and you do need to adapt, and true adaptation happens when you have a more normal shift away from visual dependence, where you lose some of that reliance on vision for balance,
yeah,
and you begin to use some of your other balance afferent signals, like from the inner ear or from your hearing or from your joint position sense.
Yep.
That's true adaptation. That is a genuine shift in the software in the brain. But what most people refer to as adaptation is actually avoidance behavior, and that's not good for recovery.
So recovery itself, then, I believe, is down to three strategies: adaptation, compensation, and habituation.
Yes. Correct. So these are slightly, I mean, they merge a little bit in terms of their meaning, but to adapt is something that happens usually spontaneously and over time. To compensate, you need something a bit more active. It's not a passive process. And the process of compensation is really what leads to recovery, and that happens at the level of the brain. And to do that, often patients will need a therapist to support them through that, and that's usually a vestibular physiotherapist,
right,
someone who understands the balance system. And it's about exposing patients gradually to the symptoms that make them ill and uncomfortable, so that the brain learns to compensate for it. And so you trigger a change or a shift in the weighting of the balance system.
So it's balance retraining then, basically?
A little bit, yes, yeah. Exactly. Using visual cues. So it's not the typical thing, you know, moving your head type balance retraining, but rather using visual cues and exposing patients. And then over time, with compensation, you habituate to it, which means that you can expose yourself to, you know, your supermarket aisle without having any symptoms.
Okay. And in terms of pills, I do remember the first thing that happened to me was they threw pills at me, and I remember the name of it. It's called Dogmatil.
Yes.
And they assumed that would be the perfect solution, presumably not even close.
No. Pills are bad for these sort of problems. And in fact, they're pills generally are bad for balance problems. And the reason is that firstly, they tend not to work very well, and most pills carry some sort of side effect, and so taking them probably is less likely to make you well and more likely to make you ill.
Yeah.
And the second is that some of these can cause a degree of suppression of the compensation process.
Yes.
So they affect the brain parts that actually help you get better and slow down the recovery. So we don't advocate the use of things like Dogmatil or Stematil, as it's other, also called, for that reason, that it's a bit of a vestibular suppressant. It suppresses the part of the brain that helps you recover. And the best treatment really is with re-exposure therapy, and that's done best by a vestibular physiotherapist.
So for people who have never even heard the term vestibular physiotherapist, who are going to see their kind of common or garden ENT specialist, yes, they may not be qualified enough to get all of this. Is that right?
That is, sadly. So this is it's a real problem for dizziness generally, whether it's visual vertigo or otherwise. Because it's dizziness symptoms are managed by a range of different health professionals. So you have ENT surgeons, you have neurologists, you have GPs, you have audiovestibular physicians, you have neurotologists, and their expertise is slightly different. So it's at the moment it's a bit hit and miss in terms of whether you see the right person. And there is certainly in the UK there is a trend to try and drive a better patient pathway, so that patients are identified at an earlier stage as to who the right specialist to see is, and then referred appropriately at that point. Rather than what tends to happen is seeing several different specialties for the same problem,
yes,
often without any conclusion. And that exacerbates the problem. It creates a sense of anxiety in patients too, I think, and a lack of confidence really in what's going on. So all those things feed negatively into the recovery.
Very interesting. So it's basically, as you alluded to earlier, about educating the health professional and saying, look, I know this term, I'm not just Mr. Google here, but there is this thing called visual vertigo, and please will you look into this for me and find somebody who's a specialist in it?
Yes, exactly.
That's the answer. Exactly. Diego, it's been absolutely fascinating. I thought I was going mad, to be honest with you. So,
rest assured you're not.
Yeah, and the supermarket.
Many others like you, I think.
And it just happened to be at the part of the supermarket that I visit quite a lot, you know. It was the alcohol section, so...
particularly relevant in that case.
Diego, been a pleasure talking to you. Thank you so much for your time.
Thank you. Pleasure.
Take care. Bye-bye. Okay.